Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
You're listening to the English language feature program for Vatican Radio. Today we go to Poland, where Pope Benedict XVI is visiting the homeland of his predecessor. Veronica Scaresbrook looks at the Pope's visit to John Paul II's hometown. Welcome to the program. I'm Charles Collins. On Saturday, Pope Benedict visited the hometown of Pope John Paul II. Veronica Scaresbrook is in Poland with the Holy Father and tells us more.
Despite overcast skies, spring has reached Wadowice, a sleepy little town nestling at the foot of the Carpathian Mountains, some 30 miles southwest of Krakow. And when Pope Benedict XVI made his way there by car on the morning of Saturday, 27th of May, looking out of the window, he could enjoy the sight of the lush green woodland, interspersed with huge lilac bushes in full bloom, while he looked forward to some charged emotional moments, during which his thoughts may have just turned to a passage in the speech he was about to deliver there. He was to quote from a German poet, Johann von Goethe, who once said, "He who wishes to understand a poet should visit his native land." In this case, the native land was that of the late John Paul II, where the Holy Father is currently on a spiritual pilgrimage, and where on Saturday he visited Wadowice, that once obscure town where the late Polish pontiff was born, one he placed on the map of the world and in the hearts of many. And the German Pope, who'd worked so closely with him, was greeted there by another person who'd been especially close to the late Polish pontiff, his longtime secretary, Cardinal Stanisław Dziwicz, recently appointed Archbishop of Krakow.
Qui in questa città, a Wadowice, è cominciato tutto.
And the Cardinal confirmed that idea. Wadowice, he said in Italian as he spoke in the market square on a makeshift podium while 200,000 people looked on, is the very place where everything began. We welcome you with that very same joy we greeted your predecessor. And when it was Pope Benedict's turn to speak, the people expressed great warmth, visibly happy he was there, happy he'd spoken in Polish.
Umiłowani bracia i siostry.
I am filled with emotion in the birthplace of my great predecessor, the servant of God, John Paul II, in this town of his childhood and young adult life, Pope Benedict said. Indeed, I could not have left out Wadowice as I make this pilgrimage in Poland, following in his footsteps, wishing to stop precisely here, in the place where his faith was kindled. And the crowd shouted with enthusiasm, thank you, in Polish. Dziękuję, dziękuję. John Paul II, the Holy Father highlighted, often referred to a sign, that of the baptismal font, one which he himself often spoke about in the Church of Wadowice. In 1979, during his first pilgrimage in Poland, he stated, "In this baptismal font, on the 20th of June, 1920, I was given the grace to become a son of God, together with faith in my Redeemer, and I was welcomed into the community of the Church." And it was precisely to this baptismal font that Pope Benedict had gone earlier to pray when he began his visit to the late Pope's hometown. Housed in the white Baroque church of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin, which stands overlooking the square, he seemed touched by this symbolic moment which brought to mind the birth of Karol Wojtyła. And a little later, turning a sharp left as he came out of the church, he walked a few yards down a side street in the shadow of the Basilica, going to 7 Koszalna Street, the house on the corner where little Lolek, as he was nicknamed then, grew up, and where today his cradle is housed. But the most moving moment of all was still to come.
Spero che la provvidenza ci conceda presto la beatificazione e la canonizzazione del nostro caro Papa Giovanni Paolo II.
Speaking off the cuff, Pope Benedict made an unexpected but much hoped-for statement, expressing the hope, in Italian, that the Church beatify and canonize the late John Paul II as soon as possible. The skies may well have been overcast in the Calvaria Marian Shrine of Passion of Our Lord, but it was spring here on Saturday and the Beskidy Hills were alive with the sound of music.
On Friday afternoon, Pope Benedict visited one of Poland's most important shrines. Veronica has that story, too.
Krakow, Poland's royal city for over five centuries, on the evening of Friday 26th of May, welcomed a special guest, someone who could be perceived as an uncrowned king if it weren't that he's a Roman pontiff. He's Benedict XVI, and when he reached here, the city delved into chaos. The people had turned out en masse to greet him, cheering madly. For a while, it was no longer Krakow the Elegant, only Krakow, the town where the late John Paul II lived for 40 years, where he was ordained priest, from where he left his archbishop's residence for Rome as Cardinal Wojtyła in 1978 to attend that conclave which would elect him to the See of Peter, the residence at Franciszkaja No. 3, the road with the clinking tram, from where Pope Benedict appeared at the window to chant and sing gaily with the crowds, just like his predecessor was wont to do every time he returned home. And the crowds shouted, "Witaj w domu," welcome home. Clearly, the people of the orphan city, in a special way the younger generations, have chosen to adopt him as he goes on a spiritual pilgrimage following in the footsteps of his predecessor. To them, on Friday evening, he appeared at the window of this residence, quipping, "Today, despite death, Pope John Paul, youthful in God, is among us." And Pope Benedict on Saturday is spending the day in the places of memory of Karol Wojtyła, among his fellow countrymen, travelling to his birthplace, Wadowice, to Kalwaria Zebrzydowska, the hillside shrine in the Beskidy Hills, where the late Pope used to go on foot to pray with his father when he was only 9 years old. And then, in the afternoon, to the majestic Wawel Cathedral, overlooking a bend on the Vistula River, the church where this young Pole once celebrated his first Mass. A very different agenda to Friday afternoons, when on his way to Krakow he'd stopped to pray at the Marian Shrine of Jasna Góra, the spiritual heart of Poland, recalling in this place how his predecessor to the See of Peter had been so many times, including that first time he returned to communist-ruled Poland as Pope in 1979, to pray before the ancient icon of the Black Madonna, crowned beneath a halo, eyes half closed, as if by tears, with a countenance of utter sorrow. But yesterday afternoon it was Pope Benedict who prayed there, while outdoors 500,000 people had gathered to attend a meeting dedicated in a special way to men and women religious, seminarians and representatives of ecclesial movements, bringing to them his message to stand firm in faith.
On Sunday, Pope Benedict will visit the Auschwitz Nazi concentration camp. Veronica Scaresbrook takes a look at this journey.
When Pope Benedict XVI released his first encyclical letter by the title of God is Love, he did so a couple of days ahead of a date the international community marks each year in a special way. It's the 27th of January, a day recognised by many nations and officialised last year by the United Nations as dedicated to the memory of the victims of the Holocaust. When hatred wiped out that love Pope Benedict so vividly reminds us to put into practice in his encyclical. This particular date for memory was chosen simply because it marks the day in 1945 when the inmates of a tragically famous Nazi concentration camp known as Auschwitz, those who still could, walked to freedom liberated by Russian troops. And ever since, this date became symbolic of that horrific targeting by the political and social engineering of the Nazis of individuals considered unfit for society, like Slavonic peoples, the Roma, the disabled, homosexuals, and that vast majority of Jews. Among those on the front line in denouncing that disturbing crime known as the Holocaust was the Holy See, ever since the days of Pope Pius XI with the encyclical condemning the Nazi regime Mit Brennender Sorge, taken secretly to Germany in 1937 and distributed in clandestinity, or since the days of the wartime Pope Pius XII, who in a Christmas message in Italian dated 1942 denounced the Holocaust, in Italian Holocausto.
Il cui orrori noi già fin dall'inizio più volte denunziamo. E l'Olocausto,
And continuing in more recent times with the late John Paul II, the Pope from Poland, who grew up at the time of that world war, only miles away from Auschwitz. A personal witness that must surely have silently set seed in the late Pope's heart, providing him with the moral strength to give voice to his convictions right from the start of his pontificate. As recorded by our Vatican Radio sound engineers and put together in this collage of voices, which includes the witness of one of Karol Wojtyła's childhood friends, Jerzy Kluger. Get ready to listen to the late Pope's voice once again.
Respect and love you to each man, because he is man.
The strong voice of Pope John Paul II highlighting human dignity, merely a year into his pontificate. The date, October 1979, the place, Ireland.
Each human community, ethnic, historical, cultural, or religious, has rights, must be respected.
The same words highlighted during the two preceding pastoral journeys abroad of that first year as Pope.
This same message I affirmed in Mexico and in Poland.
And on that first journey back home to Poland in June of that year, the son of this nation, which had had more than its share of suffering, losing as it had one-fifth of its people during the Second World War, was seen kneeling by the tombstones of the victims of what he referred to as the Golgotha of our modern world.
Golgocie naszych czasów.
Auschwitz, or in Polish, Oświęcim.
Oświęcim jest rozrachunkiem.
All victims from nations he found time to mention individually.
Polskim, angielskim, bułgarskim, cygańskim, czeskim, duńskim, francuskim.
But in a special way, the words of the Roman pontiff went to a particular group of victims, the Jews, to a people, he said, destined to be exterminated by the Nazis.
W języku hebrajskim. Przeznaczono na całkowitą eksterminację.
A people going back to our father in faith, Abraham. I have visited the ruins of the Jasinka gas ovens many times before, he said. But there was no way, he added forcefully, I would not have paid a visit here as Pope.
Nie mogłem tutaj nie przybyć jako papież.
This, he stressed, is no place to pay a fleeting visit to, but a sobering reminder of fear, of the frontiers of human hatred and destruction, the frontiers of evil. A place, he said, symbolic of all wars. Among them, the Second World War that had touched him so personally. Many of his close friends at school were tortured, deported to Siberia, or interned in concentration camps like the one in Auschwitz, so close to his home in Wadowice. Among these, his friend and schoolmate, Jerzy Kluger.
We don't talk very often about it. I mean, he, I suppose, wants to avoid this because, for me, those years are really very painful, those memories. I mean, I'm Jewish. My father was the last president of the Jewish community in Wadowice. And during the war, we did a tremendous mistake that really went into the army, that means my father and myself, and my mother, my sister, and the grandmother. They were left there. We thought that the Germans won't do anything to them because they're women. Instead, they all died in Auschwitz.
True peace must be founded upon justice, upon a sense of the untouchable dignity of men.
A tireless call for peace and dialogue, reiterated so many times during the over two decades of his pontificate, by this first Roman pontiff ever to visit a concentration camp, ever to visit a synagogue, to pray at Yad Vashem, Israel's memorial to the victims of the Holocaust.
The law of God stands in judgment over all reasons of state.
And now we leave those haunting notes French composer Olivier Messiaen wrote in a prisoner of war camp back in 1941, only to join Gilles Bevilacqua as she presents the haunting tale of one of the inmates of Auschwitz, Maximilian Kolbe, in a dramatized version produced by Sean-Patrick Lovett. Stay tuned.
The place is Auschwitz. The date, 1941. It's a hot July evening. 600 men in the striped uniform of the concentration camp are returning to base after an exhausting day's work in the cornfields. The corn is high, and the call to freedom is strong. A prisoner escapes. His absence is noticed at roll call that evening, and the camp commander, Colonel Fritsch, tells the men of Block 14 that if their companion is not found within 24 hours, 10 of them will die.
All next day, while the other prisoners are on different work assignments, the men of Block 14 stand to attention in the parade ground. If a prisoner faints, he is kicked and beaten till he gets up again. Those who are unable to rise are left in a heap. Later, they will be thrown onto a coal truck. Destination, the gas ovens.
Evening roll call. The fugitive has not been caught. Colonel Fritsch announces that he will now choose 10 victims. They'll be taken to Block 13, the underground bunker, and left to starve to death.
One man after another is chosen and dragged from his place in the ranks. Then comes the turn of Francis Gajovnicek, and he cries out in anguish for his wife and children.
Just at that moment, a man steps out of line and begins to walk slowly towards the group of doomed men. The guards raise their rifles, but the man takes no notice and continues walking. He is soon face to face with the camp commander.
What do you think you're doing?
If it please the Lager Führer, I want to take the place of prisoner Gajovnicek.
Are you crazy?
No, but I am alone in the world. His family needs him. Please.
Who are you, anyway? What's your job?
I am a Catholic priest. Maximilian Kolbe.
All right. Take your boots off. Dead men don't need boots.
Thank you.
One of the stranger aspects of martyrdom is that a number of those who have suffered it knew their destiny long beforehand and accepted it.
Raymond, later Maximilian Kolbe, belongs to this category of martyrs. That he knew his destiny was revealed by his mother in a letter she wrote after hearing of his manner of death. The episode she recounts took place when Kolbe was about 10 years old.
He was a lively child, very bright and just a bit mischievous. I remember one night he got home very late. He was dirty all over and his jacket was torn and his father was furious with him. Next day, while I was mending his jacket, I said to him, "Whatever will become of you, child?" And he burst into tears and ran from the room. Later, I asked him what was the matter, and he told me he had gone to ask Our Lady what would become of him. He said she had opened her arms and shown him two garlands of flowers, one white and one red, and asked him which one he preferred. The white flowers were for purity, the red for martyrdom. Raymond said he would take them both.
At the age of 17, Raymond Kolbe became Friar Maximilian Mary and was sent to Rome to study for the priesthood. He was ordained on April 28, 1918. But even before ordination, he'd founded an organization for the conversion of sinners, the Militia of Mary Immaculate. On October 16, 1917, seven Franciscan friars, like the knights of old, went down on bended knee and swore fealty to Mary. Soon, the monthly magazine, Knight of the Immaculate, had reached a circulation of 60,000. In 1927, Father Kolbe found a piece of marshy land about 25 miles from Warsaw, and there he founded what was to become the world's largest monastery, known as the City of the Immaculate. By 1939, it had more than 750 friars and was turning out 1 million copies a month of The Knight.
But other forces, the forces of evil, were at work, and Poland was soon overrun by the Nazis. Even before Warsaw fell, Father Kolbe had been arrested. He was released shortly after, but he knew it was not for long. He sent all but 50 of his friars away, to their families, to the north, to safety. He set up a haven for refugees and published a last issue of his magazine. "No one in the world can alter truth," he wrote. "All we can do is seek it and live it."
The Gestapo came for him on February 17th, 1941. 20 of his friars offered to take his place in prison, but in vain. Father Kolbe spent 2 months in a Warsaw prison, and then, with 320 others, he was bundled into a cattle truck, and after 4 days' journey, reached his final destination, the labor camp at Auschwitz. Over the door was a great sign: "Work makes you free." That day, May 28th, 1941, Father Maximilian Kolbe became number 16,670. There was no mistaking. It was branded forever on his left arm.
Kolbe was assigned to Block 17, reserved for priests, whom the camp commander defined useless beings and parasites of society. Tied to a cart with other Polish priests, Kolbe pulled heavy loads of gravel, cut down trees, dragged logs and branches along rough paths. One day he fell under a heavier load than usual. The guard was merciless. He laid Kolbe on the trunk and beat him 50 times with his stick. When Christ was scourged, the lashes were 49, the number prescribed by Roman law.
Colby was left for dead, and his fellow priests covered him with green branches as they passed. But when night fell, Colby managed to drag himself to the cell block. Next day, he was transferred to the infection center. He was covered with bruises and had a high fever. But he survived, and although weighing less than 100 pounds, he refused to sleep on a proper bed, insisting on a wooden bunk with a straw mattress. Dr. Rudolf Diem, the Polish doctor who cared for him, later recalled that he wanted to leave the bed to someone whose lot was worse than his. He was unable to work, and so received only half the ration of food. But he still gave some of it away to other patients. "You are young," he would say. "You must survive."
"For myself, I pray only to be reduced to dust in the service of the Immaculate, and to have my ashes blown to the four winds."
Colby's prayer was answered. As soon as he felt better, he was moved to Block 14, the farm workers' block. It was the 20th of July. Just a few days later, a man made a historic dash for freedom.
Ten men lay naked on the cement floor of the dank underground cell of Block 13. Sometimes they moaned or cried aloud in delirium. Sometimes, thankfully, they lost consciousness. But there was a difference between this group of prisoners and the hundreds who had gone to their deaths before them. Every so often, they were heard praying and even singing, so loudly that prisoners from the cells nearby joined in, and the guards had to order them to be silent.
As long as they had strength, Colby and his men prayed and sang. The guards, unnerved by their calm in the face of death, eventually refused to go near the death cell. A Polish orderly had to remove the bodies of those who had died.
By the end of a fortnight, there were only four men alive in Block 13. But the cell was needed for other victims. Colonel Fritsch gave orders to finish off the survivors. And at noon, on August 14th, Vigil of the Assumption, a male nurse entered the death cell and injected carbolic acid into the arm of each man. Father Colby, who was kneeling by the wall in prayer, comforted his companions in their last moments, as he had comforted so many others throughout his imprisonment. Smiling, he held out his arm for the needle.
And that presentation was produced by Jill Bevilacqua with the assistance of Sean Patrick Lovett. That brings me to the end of this program. Please join us tomorrow at this same time or listen in on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org for the latest on Pope Benedict XVI's apostolic journey to Poland. I'm Charles Collins.